We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for Focus is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Kyle Mabry. Today, we open the phone lines and the email message folder for questions about diet and nutrition. Our guest is licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundra. One topic we'll take up this morning, diet and heart health. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S. But here's the good news. We can improve the health and fitness of our hearts and blood vessels. We'll talk about the guidelines the American Heart Association has developed to help us. And as always, Susan is happy to field whatever questions you have on diet and nutrition. Listeners, I look forward to your phone calls and email messages. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She's also the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the ARC, that's the Activities and Recreation Center at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning.
It's crisp out there.
It is very crisp. It's a nice cool morning, but I think the warmth is coming, so that's good.
Yep. Okay. So the American Heart Association, I mentioned that organization in my introduction, it has some guidelines for heart health. Life's Simple Seven. Two of them involve food. Maintain a healthy weight and eat foods that are good for us. Mm-hmm. So what would you like to say about those two particular guidelines?
Well, I guess I would say that there's really been a focus, as we've probably all been aware, of the goal of trying to maintain a healthy weight. And that has become more of a focus through the American Heart Association and the new dietary guidelines, which just came out last week. The main focus of the dietary guidelines really goes right along with this. One of the keys is balancing calories, meaning enjoy your food, but eat less. That's kind of the main message of the dietary guidelines, and avoiding oversized portions. And so really, I think we're coming back to what is realistic in terms of portions, what are good amounts to eat. A good example, I saw the King's Speech recently, and I was just noticing the size of the plates in that movie. And of course, it was a movie, but the whole idea that, you know, we've gone from using these really relatively small plates to very large plates. And of course, as we know, just eating out more, we just tend to eat a lot more food because that's what's served in the United States. So a real focus on that goes right along with American Heart Association guidelines on trying to eat less, keep your weight down. Because, of course, the more we weigh, the more difficult it is for our heart to work. It makes sense. And that affects blood pressure, can certainly play a role in cholesterol levels and those kinds of things, too. And then when we think about the other guidelines through the American Heart Association, it's really focused on eating more produce, eating at least 4.5 cups of fruits and vegetables a day. That's one of their recommendations. Being really aware of the fat intake that you're taking in, and certainly trying to limit your saturated fat and cholesterol that you're taking in, and monitoring sodium intake as well. So, and that was one of the recommendations now in the dietary guidelines, much more strong recommendation to reduce certain foods. So they have a whole guideline area of foods to reduce, and it says compare sodium in foods like soup, bread, frozen meals, and choose foods with lower numbers. And also drinking water more instead of sugary drinks and things like that. So So I think those are the keys, and we can talk more about specific foods, too.
Okay. Well, we'll do that. But in the meantime here, we're going to take our first call this morning. This is a listener waiting for us in Dewey, Illinois, on line one. Hi.
Hello. I have recently been diagnosed with osteoarthritis in my knees, and I've been reading about eating an anti-inflammatory diet. What is that? I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, an anti-inflammatory diet not only is helpful with osteoporosis or osteopenia, osteoarthritis, but it also helps with heart disease, so it's a good timing to talk about that, too. Anti-inflammatory diet, and there are a lot of books out on it. There's a book called The Anti-Inflammatory Diet. That's a pretty good book. There are websites with anti-inflammatory recommendations for foods, but basically it's the idea of trying to eat a lot of foods that may decrease inflammation in the body, and that would be kind of focusing your foods on things like, things like the Mediterranean diet would have more fish, particularly more salmon and tuna and mackerel and sardines and fish that are high in omega-3s, more nuts and seeds. So particularly things like walnuts and almonds and nuts that are high in monounsaturated fat, more oils, things like olive oil, in particular olives, those kinds of foods. And then really high in fruits and vegetables, because we know that fruits and vegetables in general, particularly if you're eating a lot of different colors and varieties of fruits and vegetables, have a lot of antioxidants, a lot of nutrients, which may play a role in decreasing inflammation, repairing cells in the body, those kinds of things. And so one of the things people tend to do sometimes when they're trying to eat healthy is they just drop out all the fats. They just really cut down on everything. And I'll have clients come to me and they'll say, well, I got this list of foods to avoid, and it includes nuts and peanut butter and all these things that actually can be really helpful when you're trying to decrease inflammation in the body, because those good fats can really be a good source. So it might be a simple thing like maybe you eat less ranch dressing or blue cheese, but you actually go more to an oil and vinegar dressing where you're getting olive oil in there. So it's the idea of really eating more of these anti-inflammatory foods and then looking at some of the additional things that can be helpful, like particular spices like turmeric and Indian spices and things like that that may be helpful from a standpoint of inflammation.
Okay. Talk some more, if you would, Susan, about omega-3. It's a fatty acid. What's its role in the body?
Well, omega-3 fatty acids, we usually think of them as fish oil because that's generally where they're found. The general recommendation for omega-3s, if you were looking to decrease inflammation or also help with heart disease, is typically 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 grams a day of a pure fish oil. And the reason that generally, if you're looking for a therapeutic benefit, that you want to look to a supplement is because it's pretty hard even to get 1 gram a day in food. And we usually don't want to be eating that much fatty fish to get that in every day. So the omega-3s can actually in the body serve like an anti-inflammatory medication almost. I mean, it's certainly not the exact same as that, but to decrease inflammation in the body so your body can heal. And so we know that they've been definitely beneficial for people after surgery sometimes when they're trying to decrease inflammation, get back to rehab. Very helpful for some people with osteoporosis and other problems like that. And then even inflammation in the arteries, they're recommended, as well as having a benefit. Generally, if I have a client with high triglycerides, that's usually typically part of their plan, because omega-3 supplements for most people are going to decrease triglycerides too. But the idea is kind of decreasing the inflammation in your body so your body can do what it needs to do. So there are all kinds of, you know, books and websites on omega-3, you know, the omega-3 factor and omega-3 being, you know, the really the main nutrient that's helpful. And I think that some of those might go a little overboard, but the idea is it is a really helpful nutrient in food and in supplementation for many people.
Okay. I have also heard that besides fish oil, algae is another way to supplement, and that would be good for someone who is a vegan.
Right. Algae is a good way to do it. The green algae, the also looking at flax, because flax oil is a good way to get it. It's a little bit different formulation than omega-3s themselves, but or using ground flax seeds. Soybeans have some of the good fats like that too. So there are some certainly more vegetarian sources, but it is a, you know, it is a nutrient to really look at closely. I would also tell the listener that, you know, if she's really interested in this anti-inflammatory diet, There is a really good website that has this anti-inflammatory food pyramid, and that's on Dr. Andrew Weil's website. So it's just www.drweil.com, and then you can search the food pyramid that really kind of focuses on what foods are more helpful, even things added in like mushrooms and, again, soy foods and different things that you could kind of take a look at that and say, well, what could I eat off of that pyramid and make a grocery list and go get the food.
Okay, let's take a question from someone listening and who has written us an email. I have a bad habit, snacking in the evening. I know it's a no-no, but until I can make myself excuse me, I'm having a tough time with my voice this morning. But until I can make myself not snack so late in the evening, is there anything in particular to avoid or anything that might not be so bad? I often grab a bowl of cereal with skim milk.
Well, I would say two things to that. Snacking in the evening isn't such a bad thing if you don't overdo it, because this whole idea of spreading out your food throughout the day, I really believe that that's very helpful for most people. So, for example, if you have just a cup of cereal, that's what I would do. I would measure out, have one cup, make it a non-sugar cereal, and that with skim milk might be all of 150 calories, maybe 200 calories. That's very reasonable. Many people feel better having a snack before bed. That's not too much on the stomach. And there is no truth to the fact, or the idea that if you eat at night, it's going to be stored as fat more readily and all these things. The body's going to go by what it needs. If you're still eating within your calorie level, even if you have 200 calories at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, you're not going to store more fat or cause more trouble with that. So I think I would say if you feel like having a snack at night, if that's your norm, that's my norm. I like to have a snack before bed. It makes me feel better. I feel better going to bed. I'm not hungry, you know, sleep better. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing wrong with that. But what I would choose is just something like she's choosing, a small bowl of cereal with some milk, maybe something like a yogurt with some fruit. It's good to have a little protein mixed with carbohydrate before you go to bed. We think we probably rest better that way. It gives you some amino acids and some carbohydrate to go with that. Even something like a half of a sandwich, and maybe you have a tangerine and a half a turkey sandwich. Think of it as a mini meal that's still really healthy for you. And again, that might be all of about 200 calories. You know, a good thing to do is to kind of maybe choose some different options that you like and figure out the calories of those options. If you're online, there's a lot of resources to do that. A website I've been using a lot with my clients is one that's, it's just www.myfitnesspal.com, all together, myfitnesspal.com. You can get an online account. It's all free. You can go in and put in the foods that you're eating. It gives you a breakdown over the meal and over the day of the calories, the protein, the carbohydrate. It's really a nice way to track yourself and see what you're doing. So that might be helpful. You know, the listener could even put in some different snacks she likes. I would keep them to about 200 calories. And that I think that that's perfectly fine. I don't see any real problem with snacking at night as long as it's reasonable with the calories.
Has there been any research in as far as maybe spreading out your calories through the day in smaller meals and smaller servings in terms of keeping maintaining a healthy weight in terms of losing weight?
Well, there certainly have been a lot of studies that have looked at that. And, I mean, two things it really comes down to. How many calories have you taken in during the day? And if that's a little bit less than what you need, you're probably going to lose weight. The other thing is, if you spread out your calories during the day and you make it so that you get satisfied when you do eat, you tend to be fine with eating only every 3 or 4 hours. You don't need to usually eat between that. The downside of snacking is there have been some studies also that have said, well, when people start snacking, if they just add that on top of big meals, it's really too many calories. So just stop the snacking. And there are people I work with who just do much better without snacks. They just feel they can just eat their meals and then they don't overeat that way, as long as they don't have snacks. And that's fine, too. It's really more individual. But I think for most people, energy-wise, being able to maintain their energy throughout the day, not get too hungry, it's a good idea to plan a little snack in. Even if it's something as simple as maybe putting 2 tablespoons of almonds in a little containers and having those at work and have that with a piece of fruit. Again, that's maybe 100, 150 calories. But it's enough to tide you over. I especially find that's helpful to have a snack around 3 or 4 in the afternoon. Then when you go home, you can prepare your dinner, not have to eat while you're doing it, find that you can not overeat, because that's when we munch. I mean, most of us start to munch when we get home. If from the time we get home to the time we go to bed. That's usually the high-calorie time.
Wow.
And during the day, most of us are pretty good. We're busy.
Yeah.
We might stop for a meal. But so having a snack that kind of prepared or ready to go at 3 or 4 in the afternoon can really help us avoid overeating later.
Okay. Let's take another email question. I take Fosamax for osteoporosis. I like to drink low-calorie drinks like Crystal Light, Kool-Aid, Diet Coke, etc. One of their main ingredients, citric acid, malic acid, etc. I've heard these drinks are bad for calcium in the body. What do you think about this?
Well, I wouldn't worry quite so much about those as long as your calcium intake is high enough overall. One problem we sometimes have, let's say Diet Coke, for example, if you do drink a lot of Diet Coke because it's real high in phosphorus, you may not absorb all the calcium that you should absorb. The body likes to have maybe a 2-to-1 ratio of calcium to phosphorus in the body, so for bone strength. And so if you end up having a lot of things that, particularly like the Diet Coke, that are dark and have more of the phosphates, I'd be more concerned about that than, let's say, the citric acid. But the other issue is, yes, if you're drinking a lot of those things, does that change the way your stomach feels and, let's say, the acidity of your stomach? And then does that affect how well you absorb some of these other things? That could be an issue. So my rule of thumb is to say, well, if you have one or two things in the day that are either diet or maybe not very good for you, something that is what we might consider an unhealthy food, maybe you have one or two during the day, that's probably reasonable for most people if it's not a huge serving. But over that, I'd look for other options. So let's say, for example, if someone's drinking 2 Diet Cokes and 2 other diet drinks and having a diet, you know, yogurt or something like that, that's maybe, a little excessive. I'd say 1 or 2 diet products a day. Mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't go more than that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, you know, that we can do is maybe if you like Crystal Light, you could squeeze an orange into a big container of water and keep that in your fridge. And most people love the taste of that, because the whole thing with something like Crystal Light is you're going to drink more water if it tastes good to you. So people tend to stay better hydrated drinking these other things than drinking water, but maybe finding a natural way to get water mm-hmm. in your system where it's a little bit flavored would be a better option than using a lot of the diet products.
Okay, let's take a call now from a listener in Piatt County on line 4. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I think you've probably covered this before, but I read an article this past week. It was in the Tribune about microwaving broccoli, and that the heat of the microwave pretty much cancels out the benefits, the antioxidant benefits of broccoli. And I thought, number one, is that true? And then number two, wouldn't that be for all foods then, that the microwave would be harming all food, you know, nutrients? And then if you're steaming it on the stove, which is what they recommended, wouldn't that be the same thing? Or is, you know, the microwave factor is probably different? So I guess I just like an opinion on that, because I eat a lot of broccoli and I eat a lot of vegetables and I do use the microwave, so I guess I'd kind of like for you to give your opinion on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really good question. I didn't see that particular article myself, but I do know when studies have looked at this very issue, and there have been studies here at the U of I that have looked at this, then generally the recommendation is eat it fresh if you can, if not, steam it very low time. Steaming is nice because you can cook it very quickly, and yet you don't lose as many of the nutrients, so that makes sense. Microwaving generally is very fast, too, so I would think that that wouldn't be as big of a problem, but maybe there's other things going on with the microwave. I know microwaving usually is recommended after steaming on top of the stove, and so that may be why. One thing I would say is for everybody just to be aware of the time, because mm-hmm. it seems that you know, the longer the food is exposed to the heat, the more nutrients tend to be lost. So, you know, maybe most people might be very fine, you know, enjoy the vegetables if they're steamed, cooked just a minute, but they may leave them on there another 3 or 4 minutes, and then you really have lost more nutrients. Same thing with the microwave. The nice thing about the microwave is you can just steam cook those generally very quickly. But I guess that what we usually recommend is eat it fresh if you can. If not, steam cook it very small amount of time. If you can't do that, then microwave it. If you can't do that, then cook it in water, which really isn't the best way to do it, but still how a lot of people do it. But I think the getting the the broccoli, let's say, for example, is so high in fiber, it's high in certainly vitamin C that we lost some in that cooking, but it's high in other nutrients too. And so I would still think you're doing a great job eating it, but if you eat a lot of it, like you say, it might be best to try to eat more fresh or steam cook it very quickly.
Does it also have the same fiber benefits if you put it in the blender and use it as a broccoli soup? I just always have wondered that because, you know, you steam it and then you fix it with whatever you're going to use as your base and you put it in the blender. Is it still fibrous?
Well, it is still fibrous. I mean, you're still going to get the benefit. It may be a little bit more broken down, mm-hmm. obviously, than it would have been otherwise. But it's still a really good option. And I guess I would offer one more way to think about using broccoli or cauliflower or other vegetables if you want to cook them really quickly. Let's say asparagus or something, that if you're making a big pot of pasta and you already have that pasta water, even throwing the broccoli in for 20 seconds kind of really makes it so that it tastes good. It's still crisp, but it's cooked a little bit. And then you don't lose too many nutrients either. Even though it's in the water, it's very, very short time in the water. And a lot of people like it that way. It kind of gets rid of some of the gases of broccoli, but still you've maintained most of the nutrients because it's been so quick.
Okay. Well, thank you for your help.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus, and our guest this morning is registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions about diet and nutrition with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. I suspect that if you're getting the recommended amount of, or even more, it's, of vegetables, I guess I wouldn't be too concerned about how they were prepared, just so that you were, taking them in, because who doesn't love, vegetables in a soup or a stew or oven roasted?
Right.
It's got to be good for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the key, is that we know that the amount you take in probably outweighs everything else, because you're still, again, getting the fiber, you're still getting some key nutrients, you're still getting benefit from that, and then try to eat some raw or some fresh so you get even more benefit, and that's a good way to look at it. But it sounds like that listener was doing a great job of eating broccoli, which is so good, and getting that in. And I'll have to look at that article, because obviously the way you cook things really does make a difference in the nutrients that are available. But keep the idea that cook it the least amount of time you can get by with and still enjoy it. That's generally a good rule of thumb when you're talking about vegetables.
In general, how far or how close are we to consuming the recommended number of servings of fruits and vegetables?
Well, we're not that close. I mean, there have been studies to look at saying, well, we might be getting one or two servings on average a day. Certainly a lot of people aren't doing that. When we look at the recommendations, again, for fruits and vegetables through the American Heart Association, it's 4.5 cups a day, which, if you eat fruits and vegetables, really isn't that insurmountable, because you could easily get in at least a cup in the morning or maybe two with your fruits, and you just have to really be mindful to add fruits and vegetables with all your meals. And maybe make one meal pretty high in produce in general. So maybe that I recommend to people making your dinner meal, at least having two or three different options for fruits and vegetables at night, because that's a time we might have a little more time to prepare it or have those things around. But there's still, I mean, there are studies come out and say there's a good percentage of people who really don't get much in the way of fruits or vegetables, maybe French fries, but that really doesn't count. And so we're still we've got a ways to go. And I think we do know that most people, when they start increasing fruit and vegetable intake, they lower their calories. Makes sense, because it fills us up. It's fiber, not very many calories in those foods. And so it kind of all goes with these new dietary guidelines of trying to just really limit total calories as much as you can and boosting up those fruits and vegetables.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Kankakee on line 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
I missed one call as I was calling you, so I hope this topic hasn't been covered already. sometime within the last few years, I read that if food is just cooked very slightly, the body assimilates it more, assimilates the nutrients more easily. Now, has that idea been just dropped, or is that true?
Well, I think it depends on the nutrient. There are many foods that are a little bit easier to digest when they have been cooked lightly, like you say, maybe steamed. And a good example might be something like broccoli or cauliflower, these gassy vegetables that once a little bit of that gas is released, the body can utilize it a little bit better. And so that's very true. And I think when we start getting down to the nitty-gritty of each nutrient in a food, we find that some nutrients, maybe their intake or their absorbability is enhanced when you cook them. A good example is tomatoes. If you think about tomatoes and the lycopene in tomatoes, which is a key antioxidant, when they're cooked, particularly cooked with fat, let's say if you have olive oil with tomatoes in a recipe, that lycopene content really goes up because it's more available. But the vitamin C content generally goes down because it's exposed to air and the heat, and you lose some of the vitamin C. Overall, it's still a really healthy product. And so I think, as you mentioned earlier, Celeste, what I think is important as a dietitian is to say, well, let's just work first on getting more fruits and vegetables in, and then knowing that some nutrients really might be better absorbed when they're heated, when the tissue's broken down a little bit in the food, those kinds of things, than necessarily worrying that, you know, we've got to watch each vitamin and what's happening to those. I'm sure there's lists from food chemists someplace or food scientists looking at the best foods to cook, the best foods not to cook. But in general, you're right. There are some ways that we absorb nutrients better when a food is cooked a little bit. And then there's the whole idea of thinking about raw food eating, which a lot of proponents of raw food eating believe that when you have those natural enzymes in the food themselves, when they haven't been cooked, you know, you utilize the food much better because you've got some helpers in there. You've got the enzymes. So, and there's some truth to that too. So I think, you know, varying what you're eating, not worrying so much about how it's cooked, but kind of getting a lot of fresh and cooked and even frozen. And I still get people asking me questions about frozen vegetables saying they're so easy with those fresh packs that you throw in the microwave, but is that a good way to cook it? And it's still going to be really healthy, even if it's not fresh. That gets you more produce. So that's good.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. Well, one of the things that you said right at the top of the show I think was interesting and something that maybe we should just kind of relax a little bit. You know, the new food guidelines, enjoy your food.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
Enjoy your food. You know, make sure you've got your plant material in there big time.
Right.
And don't go overboard. And but enjoy it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that at maybe trying new tastes, I mean, thinking about one of the guidelines is making sure you're getting your whole grains in there. And that's really kind of a fun way for people to try new foods is to think about not just eating whole wheat pasta and whole wheat bread and things like that, but maybe trying some whole wheat couscous or trying some rye berries or something different. So you're seeing if you like different foods. And that's part of healthy eating, too, is expanding your palate and learning about different cultures of foods and those kinds of things.
Yeah, because food is such a pleasurable thing, not only in terms of enjoying it and tasting it, but, you know, doing it with people that we care for.
Exactly. And the benefit of eating foods in a comfortable atmosphere and enjoying cooking them together and those kinds of things is usually we get much more satisfied with less food because we're enjoying the process of the food, we're enjoying the company at mealtime. It's why it's so important for parents to try very hard to keep a relaxed atmosphere at mealtime so that kids enjoy coming to mealtime and it's a time they can relax too. And we know that we tend to not overeat as often. We tend to eat more appropriate portions. We're more aware of our intake, our hunger, our satiety when we're in a relaxed atmosphere with eating. And so all those things are really helpful just from a mealtime standpoint. Mm-hmm.
Let's take another call. This is a listener joining us from Newton, Illinois on line one. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question about female hair loss. Several months ago, I'm going to say 5 or 6 now, my wife and I went on some lower calorie diets and started exercising. We're in our 60s. And she tries to keep her calorie intake to about 1,000 to 1,200 calories per day. sometimes a little less. And she's noticed recently a little more hair loss than she might expect, you know, when she washes her hair in the evenings. And we're wondering if calorie restrictions have any adverse effects on female hair loss. I'll listen now to your answer. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, your question is actually not that unusual in terms of questions I get. And it is true that if you're consistently not getting what you need nutrient-wise and total energy, which is calories, and along with those lines, if key nutrients for hair and skin and nails are low, and I would think particularly things like protein, essential fatty acids that are important for hair and skin and nails and things like that, if those nutrients are low on a consistent basis and if calorie intake is low, then the body does start responding in certain ways. So it could be other things, but it certainly could be the fact that maybe the diet's been low enough for a long enough period of time. And particularly if you're exercising and doing a good job of kind of working out, and then your protein needs are higher too. And so at the very minimum, protein needs would be half your body weight in pounds. So let's say if 120 pounds, that's 60 grams of protein, maybe even a little bit more when you're exercising. And so that would be something I would kind of do some diet analysis, either work with a dietitian to make sure your plan is really set for what you want to do, because it sounds like you're really doing the right thing. Sounds like you're trying to, you know, be healthy, do things the right way, cut calories enough to kind of lose some weight and be in good shape. So, you know, you're doing a great job there. It might be just a few tweaks in the diet plan would provide enough of the key nutrients to help prevent future problems with the hair and skin and those kinds of things.
Okay, very good. This is Focus. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrot is our guest this morning. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Susan Kundrot is a sports and wellness nutritionist. She is an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She is also the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the ARC. That's the Activities and Recreation Center at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. One of the things that caught my attention in the newspaper recently was the recommendation that we cut down on salt drastically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, salt is in a lot of foods we eat. And here I want to talk with you a little bit about labels. What does a label that says low sodium mean? What qualifies a product as low sodium or very low sodium? And maybe give us the skinny on salt.
Well, I think to look at it from a broad sense, typically, as Americans, we tend to eat a lot more salt than we need. And food companies are starting to respond to this. Major food companies are cutting down the sodium in a lot of foods, and that's great. So I think that's going to be a big help to us. So we have, you know, the recommendations really are between 1,500 milligrams and 2,000 milligrams a day of sodium for overall health for most people. Now, there are certainly people, particularly athletes and folks who need more sodium than that. That's not going to be enough for them. But in general, that's our recommendation. And the American Heart Association does recommend 1,500 milligrams a day or less of sodium. So if you look on a label, something can say lower salt, you know, something like that. That doesn't necessarily mean anything. If it does say low sodium, if it's a low sodium product, then that should be 140 milligrams of sodium or less. And if it's very low sodium, generally that's 35 milligrams of sodium or less per serving. Now, that's the other thing to remember is it's per serving. So if you eat three servings of something, even if it's a low sodium product, that may be too much sodium for you, depending upon what your recommendations and your needs are. But the main place we're going to get sodium is probably eating out, because a typical meal, if you went to a fast food restaurant, could easily be 2,000 milligrams of sodium. So you could get your daily intake in one meal. That's not unusual, particularly if you're having salted fries and stuff like that with a meal. So that's probably the first place if we're trying to look at sodium, is what are you eating when you eat out? Because that's very difficult. And, of course, most restaurants want things to taste good. They want people to come back. So often they'll be much higher in sodium than we might use at home. So that's number one. And the second one is these things that may be naturally very high or high because producers have put more sodium in them for preservatives or taste. And we would think of things like packaged meals that you might, you know, a packaged noodle meal or meals like, you know, soup meals or frozen meals or those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Now, there are frozen meals that are lower. Some of the heart-healthy frozen meals are certainly better. But anything like that that's frozen, canned items. So, you know, I would think of something like if you're buying ravioli, for example, that's going to be real high in sodium. Canned vegetables are generally very high in sodium, along with canned soups and things. So being aware of what you're taking in and how it's processed is really going to be a key thing. Sometimes the challenge is if you're eating on a budget, you might have to have more things like canned vegetables and canned or packaged items because they're less expensive.
Yeah. I am seeing, though, on the shelves, you know, two different products, same company.
Mm-hmm.
One is lower sodium.
Yes.
So that's a hopeful sign.
Yes, that's helpful. And I think we'll see more of these products simply because there's been a lot of push on industry to help people achieve these goals with lower fat products, lower sodium products, and things like that. And then the other thing to keep in mind is just table salt that we would use. So, you know, a teaspoon of salt is about 2,300 milligrams. So if you get those little packets of salt, you know, those little square packets you might get if you go out to a restaurant mm-hmm. or somewhere, particularly fast food restaurant, those are usually about a quarter teaspoon. So one of those packets is about 500 or 600 milligrams of sodium, just to give people an idea. So if you use just one of those little packets, that's maybe a third of your daily intake if you're watching your sodium. So it's a lot.
That's a lot.
So what I would do with shaking salt, I would shake a little bit into your hand and then maybe take a pinch of that and put it on your food instead of just shaking it directly on your food. And that'll really cut down with the amount you take in. And then be aware of sauces and dressings and all those mm-hmm. kinds of things that tend to be high.
Okay. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes. A lot of the food bank food is canned. I've often wondered, when you're dealing with vegetables especially, should you throw out the water that is around the vegetables? Because I imagine that there's quite a bit of nutrient in the liquid. Same with fruits. Mm-hmm. They're more sugary. But as a general rule, should you throw out the fluid that's with the vegetables or the fruit on the basis that the industry has too much salt and too much other things, sugar, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, that's what I would do. I would, if you're concerned about sodium in particular or sugar, which a lot of the fruits will be, particularly foods that we might get that are lower cost, they tend to be in sweetener or in a syrup or something like that. I would rinse, I would throw them off, I would put them in a colander, rinse them, and drain them, and then also rinse them. And the same thing with vegetables. You won't get rid of all the salt doing that with vegetables, but it definitely helps. So drain a can of corn, then rinse the can of corn, and then go ahead and heat it up.
Because are you losing a bunch of other nutrients at the same time?
Well, you certainly might be losing some nutrients in the fruit. I don't think you really would be. You'd mostly be losing the sugar. In the canned vegetables, you're losing some, but because it's already cooked and already canned, probably the bulk of what you've lost is already lost. So I would, you know, the sodium amount really can be lowered by doing that, maybe by a third or so, which is really helpful. So if sodium is the main concern, I would definitely drain it and rinse it and then eat the food because you're still maintaining the fiber and some of the other key nutrients that are in there.
My concern is with low-income people especially and with food banks which often take in canned food, that is a high-sodium diet for those people.
Well, that is a big concern, and I'll say, you know, I have some experience in that area because I'm on the board of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, so that's our local 14-county area food bank, and one of the big focus areas that we've been looking at is being able to provide higher quality food and more fresh food. And so the more we can, you know, be able to provide fresh fruits and vegetables, of course, that's going to be so much better than having all the processed foods or being able to provide some of the fresh baked goods and things like that that are going to be better for people. So that's certainly our focus. And I think that's the focus of many food banks around the country to try to secure some of these other foods that would be healthier because, you know, one of the goals is trying to get everybody healthier food.
Well,
and
one of the things people can do is to call in when they find high sodium or whatever to write a note to the industry, because overall it's the industry that needs to reduce it gradually. They're not going to do it quickly. But if they gradually reduce it, then we're all in better shape.
That's exactly right, and I think that is what is happening. I think that many food companies have responded.
The big companies in the industry are doing this. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long it takes to roll out a whole new, you know, way of doing things, but it is underway.
Right.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call this morning. Let's take another call. This is a listener, in Robinson on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I was a patient at Cleveland Clinic in May, and when I got my medication report, it said that I calcium carbonate 3,750 milligram tablets. And I looked at that and I thought, well, that is really strange. So for all these months, I've had this question in my mind. And it says, note, 1,250 milligrams of calcium carbonate equals 500 milligrams of calcium. And so then I looked it up in my Consumer Reports medication guide, and it says a calcium salt contains calcium along with other substances such as carbonate or gluconate. Some calcium salts have more calcium, elemental calcium, than others. For example, the amount of calcium in calcium carbonate is greater than in calcium gluconate. To give you an idea of how different calcium supplements vary in calcium content, the following chart explains how many tablets of each type of supplement will provide 100 milligrams of elemental calcium. When you look for a calcium supplement, be sure the number of milligrams on the label refers to the amount of elemental calcium and not to the strength of each tablet. And my question is, I can't find on any bottle how much elemental calcium is in each thing. And I just thought this was something I'd never heard of again before, you know.
Yes. Well,
so, do you know anything about this? My own doctor suggested I send it to Nancy Snyderman or Dr. Zorba or somebody like that, because I don't understand. I mean, I'm a nurse for 50-some years. Mm-hmm. You know, I read all the medication things, and I've never heard of this concept.
Well, I think that the main concept is that if you look at a pill or whatever, a calcium supplement, let's say for an example, there's going to be an amount of the total, and often that's a weight amount of the whole pill. And what that is, let's say that's 1,250 milligrams, which includes everything in there. And then there's going to be amount that is just the regular calcium that's in there. What we go by from trying to get the right amount of calcium in the diet and with supplements is going to be that amount that is just the calcium, which in most cases, let's say in many of the calcium carbonate or calcium gluconate supplements, that's going to be generally 500 to 600 milligrams of calcium in that actual supplement, which is why for most people, if they're taking calcium and they need an additional 1,000 or 1,500 milligrams a day, they're going to probably have to take that 2 or 3 times a day. So the total amount, the 3,750 or so that you mentioned originally, probably is including everything, the calcium, the carbonate, everything.
Oh, it is.
Yes.
Definitely it is.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was saying, like it says calcium carbonate, the strength of each tablet in milligrams is like 625 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was, and then it says your amount of elemental calcium per tablet is 250.
Mm-hmm.
So are they giving me elemental or are they giving me the strength of the tablet? I guess that's my question.
Well, the 250 would give you the actual elemental calcium. And it kind of depends on what your recommendations are. Sometimes we'll recommend just based on the calcium, let's say the 500 milligram supplement that has calcium, and knowing that you're not going to absorb all that.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of depends on an individual person's need. But and then I guess that brings up the point that with calcium intake, you don't want to go too high because you base it also on what you're getting diet-wise.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very, you know, very confusing. Usually one calcium supplement that says 500 milligrams of calcium would be about the amount you could absorb in one time.
Mm-hmm.
So generally we say take one of those at one point
like
a day.
And if you want to take 1,500.
Right. And usually when you're looking at 1,500, that's including, you know, that would be based on a 500 milligram supplement, which is what typically people have.
Right,
which is generally the amount that we recommend, no more than 3 of those a day. unless someone has a particular need that makes it a lot higher. But certainly, you know, I have open hours at Strawberry Fields on Wednesdays from 11 to 1. And one thing people do is they bring by supplements, and I can at least help them understand what's in them. There's certain amounts and things like that. And you're more than welcome to do that, too.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the call this morning. This is Focus. We have about 7 minutes left in this portion of the program this morning with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And our email address, if you'd like to drop us an email message, is will-talk@illinois.edu. I wonder how long, since you have a hand in advising folks about diet and nutrition, and you're also always, you know, doing a lot of reading and work that way, and you're on the board of the food bank, I wonder if you have any sense, what's your sense of how the industry, the food industry, is, you know, doing in terms of getting us lower sodium, better products in, you know, in processed foods?
Right. Well, I think that there's obviously a long way to go. Some of it is, I'm sure, cost, and even change in packaging and things like that prevents some companies from making these changes because of the cost associated with that. But as one of the listeners mentioned, you know, put pressure on, make yourself known, you know, put pressure on people. Groups like the Center for Science and the Public Interest, for example, and that's a group that has really encouraged, they really were behind putting trans fat on the labels. That was a huge thing to get that done. And they really were the ones kind of, they're not a very big group, but they really tried to get some, you know, energy going behind that. And eventually, of course, it was done. And so I think that they've been very instrumental with the whole sodium issue, too, and trying to, let's really try to bring this down. And so I think that's what it takes, and it takes enough people being concerned and our major health concerns here. So certainly I think it's better. I think what we probably need to do a better job of is making actual fresh food more available to everybody and more affordable to everybody if we can do that. And, you know, this is a really great community to be in. We should all be very proud of what's been going on here in our community. Between the farmers markets and trying
community
to get local.
Community gardens.
It's wonderful, really. So there are different opportunities to help everybody here where we live. And I think if we can keep, you know, the co-op and different places where you've got different options for local food. And so I think there's a lot going on here that maybe we can help. Even being able to use food stamps for buying fresh produce is great, the link card and different things that have really transpired and helped people. So if we can keep doing that, and then also know that it's okay to have some things that are frozen and canned and processed, and
sure,
but maybe you can rinse them and you can do some other things that might bring those down to help people.
Okay, let's take another call now. A listener on line 2 in Urbana. Good morning.
Two things. That Center for Science and the Public Interest puts out a great newsletter called Nutrition Action, and I would really encourage people. It isn't that expensive, and they evaluate products. Unfortunately, we don't have a Trader Joe's, but they tell you, you know, if you have to have fast food from the frozen food case, you know, which are the better things. And the other thing, I hope that WILL in their cookbook after this one that's going to be done would do something on vegetables. I think the reason many of us don't eat more is we want good recipes where they taste good and they don't take a long time to prepare. And I can recommend one from Moosewood's big latest cookbook, which is sweet potato pancakes, which I just had for breakfast. And for one serving, you get a cup of shredded sweet potatoes, and it doesn't take long to fix. So I hope you do that cookbook.
Okay.
Thanks.
So the recommendation would be V is for vegetables.
V is for vegetables. That's a great recommendation. And your recommendation for the Nutrition Action newsletter is probably my favorite newsletter I get every every month. The website for that Center for Science and Public Interest is cspinet.org. And so that would be something good to look at. And I think the moose wood is a great, that sounds like a great recipe, makes me hungry for those. So.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for her call this morning. And before we go, I wanted to mention to listeners that Susan brought in a very colorful handout today, and it's about the DASH diet, which is the dietary approach to stop hypertension. And so, listeners, if you'd like a copy of this, drop us a line at Focus, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, 61801. 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. How easy is it to follow the DASH guidelines, Susan?
Well, the DASH guidelines really focus on more fruits and vegetables, no big surprise there, and making sure you're getting in your 2 to 3 servings of low-fat or non-fat milk and dairy, and using whole grains if you can. It's basically kind of like a pyramid plan, but it's certainly very balanced, very low in salt, low in sodium, and low in sugar. And so part of the whole idea with a DASH plan, we know that for people with hypertension or even to prevent hypertension, getting more of these fruits and vegetables is helpful. Partly you're going to get more potassium. The listener mentioned sweet potatoes, one of the highest potassium foods that helps with blood pressure regulation too. And if you're not getting too many calories by eating all these foods high in fiber and everything, maybe you're going to manage your weight better, which obviously affects blood pressure in most people if you can keep your weight down. And so the whole idea, I think, is having the food available. Obviously, we've got to be able to purchase the food and afford the food. But if you're able to get more fruits and vegetables, if you're able to eat more at home, maybe cook more at home, or when you do go out, just really always think, I'm going to get a salad too. Can I get another vegetable? It's like I tell my athletes when they're traveling, get a side of steamed vegetables, get a salad if you're trying to eat lean, and make it easy for you to eat enough but still get your produce in. And I think that's really the key.
Okay. There we will leave it for this month. Susan, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.